Many of you will be familiar with the name of Bertrand Russell. He was the famous mathematician, a famous philosopher, highly educated man, quite a thinker, and also an inveterate enemy of Christianity. In his book, Why I Am Not a Christian, he said quite a number of things that were important and things that Christians would need to listen to throughout various of his writings indeed, as well as propagating a considerable heap of nonsense. But one of the things that he did say that we should give consideration to, he said most Christians would rather die than think. And in fact, most do. Most Christians would rather die than think. And in fact, most do. Well, I'm making the assumption this afternoon that the dear believers before me, that you fall into the category of thinking Christian. The very fact that you have come to spend these three sessions on a May Day holiday is an indication that your mind is oriented towards spiritual things. And I trust the Lord will help us, that our thinking powers will be activated in His Word by the power of the Holy Spirit. And before the day is over and we disperse, that we will have done at least a little bit of rigorous thinking. I will try and keep in mind the variety in the audience and try and adjust my message accordingly. Now, as I told the brethren, the subject, as advertised, our brother has just mentioned it, is spiritual survival in a secular society. That is what I said. I appreciate the advertising that was done. In actual fact, I had a slightly larger title in mind, and I gave that to the brethren for the sake of abbreviation. I didn't want the BM to be too costly. Have to economize and cut finances. What I had in mind, the full title was this: The Secrets of Spiritual Survival in a Secular Society. And I mention that for this reason, that I'm going to take the title as more or less the guide for the consideration of each one of the sessions. We'll begin at the tail end. We'll work back towards the beginning. In this present meeting, I want to speak about secular society. What is it? In the next session, in the will of the Lord, I want to say something about spiritual survival. Can it be done? And in the concluding session, I want to look at some of the secrets that will guarantee spiritual survival. So that I hope you'll be able to follow at least the broad framework of some of the details elude you, that you'll have a fair idea of where we are going in our consideration of the subject, the secrets of spiritual survival in a secular society. Now, as we come to this first matter, a secular society, I think we have a little piece of rather knobby work, a little piece of semi-technical material to deal with, first of all. If you can give me your mind, things will slacken up and things will ease off after a few minutes. We have to think about some definitions, some matters of terminology, and I have to mention perhaps some statistics. And those things can be boring and off-putting, but do your best just to follow through with me. Now, there are three terms that I think we'll have to try and get our minds around so that we can lead into the subject with some degree of intelligence and fair-mindedness. The first is the term secular. The second is the term secularization. And the third is the term secularism. I repeat those again because these things will be fundamental for what I will later say. What is secular? What is secularization? What is secularism? Now, as far as secular is concerned, there are many occasions when that particular adjective is neutral and harmless. There is a secular side to all of our lives. I'm speaking now about how we manage to just live physically in the world. The houses that we live in, They have been built in a secular world, maybe by people who had nothing to do with Christianity. The schools that we go to, they are not Christian schools to the greater part, secular schools. The places of employment where you work. The word secular just means, in that context, work a day, daily routine in living. It is legitimate, normal, general living, and the word is not loaded with any evil connotation. In our schools, in our places of employment, and in our shopping, and all that kind of thing, we have lives that can be described as secular. But then, things change rapidly. Once we move to this second term that I have identified, the term secularization. Now, the word secular refers to a sphere of life and a form of activity. The term secularization, it refers to a process. A process. Now, there is a debate amongst scholars and those who have looked carefully at this whole business as to exactly when this process began. I'm inclined to put it well back. But the process of secularization, it has bitten into our modern world with a venom. Secularization is that process by which gradually, subtly, and yet ever so emphatically, things that are biblical, things that are religious in the best sense of that word, things that are related to God and Christ and His Word, become sidelined. They become pushed out of the public forum. And that's a very important comment. What I'm speaking about now is what we could call either the secularization of society or the privatization of Christianity. So that you go to your work on Monday morning. You come back on Friday evening. You have a day of leisure, perhaps recreation, on Saturday. And if you are that way inclined, you can dabble in this God business, as they speak, these spiritual things, Bible things. You can dabble in them on Sunday as a kind of a sideline. But the main part of your life, keep them out. Push these things onto the periphery. Have spiritual and scriptural things sidelined, so that instead of becoming the main thing in a person's life, if we succumb to secularization, we will find ourselves that Christianity is something that we will practice privately. We will never mention it in the public forum. We will never mention it in the place of our employment. We will never mention it in the circle of our social context. It is a private business. Very much like as if the man likes skiing, well, he goes and he does skiing. If another man likes bowls, he goes and he does bowls, and nobody says a word. And if you like Christianity, you go and do Christianity. And it's just a kind of a leisure pastime. Well, of course, we're not just too able to accept that. But secularization is the process of pushing these. Actually, I read you a definition by one of the experts on the matter. He said, properly defined. Now listen, it's quite a mouthful here, so just listen to it. And do your best to take in at least the main idea. Remember, it's pushing Christianity from the public center until it's marginalized right out on the edges of life. Properly defined, secularization is the process through which the decisive influence of religious ideas and institutions has been neutralized in successive sectors of society and culture, making religious ideas less meaningful and religious institutions more marginal. In particular, it refers to how our modern consciousness and ways of thinking are restricted to the world of the five senses. Now that's the process that is gradually going on, and it's wearing down people in the world. It has made them captives the secularization process, and the danger is it could also filter into our ideas as well. Now, then thirdly, behind that process, which is so subtle that maybe you can hardly even detect it, remember there's a very sinister philosophy. Those philosophies, actually a combination of philosophies, those philosophies are covered by the umbrella term secularism. Now, it's the philosophies of secularism, and they drive the process of secularization. You say, but it's just the way society's going. Things have slipped a bit over the last 20 years. And sure, what can you do about it? It's just one of those things. It's the way Britain is going. Now, listen to me. It's not just the way it's going. It's the way it's being pushed. And it's being pushed not by dumbbells. It's being pushed by men who have very, very acute minds that have rejected every notion of God and anything connected with God, and they sit in professorial chairs. No slight on professorship. And they occupy positions of influence in the world of thinking, and they dominate. They dominate the channels of the media, and through the media, newspapers, etc. And I tell you, the best vehicle which they have for the retailing of the philosophies of secularism and for the spreading of the process of secularization, the best vehicle they have had in years is a machine called the TV. And they have used it well. So that everything's just pumped out on the TV. Everybody in every home across the country, they are all listening to the same kind of brainwash. And there's a homogenization of everybody's thinking. And everybody is just being blended and caught up in the one great melting pot of anti-God philosophical ideas. And this thing is in the very air that we breathe. And it's getting into the very pores of our mental skin. And when we come to assembly life, of course, there are times when I hear Brennan talk about how to arrange meetings and how to engage in the work of the Lord. And I say to myself, secularization. Secularization. If you bring the secular mind into spiritual things, it won't be too long until you'll have the ark of the Lord on a Philistine turf. And who knows what might happen after that. There's so much for those key terms in our consideration. But you're immediately, as your thinking processes kick in, and I know some of you are nearly gone already, but you're all right. We'll be back to earth just in a couple of minutes. With a bang and a bump, I can tell you. You say, that's all very good, Gilliland, but the problem is, you've talked there for 15 minutes about words, and you've talked and talked and talked, and my problem is, there's not one of them in the Bible. No. That is a problem. Well, if a man can't find his message in the Bible, he has to put it in. So, I'm going now just to try and show you. Well, the Bible doesn't use secular or secularization or secularism, and it doesn't use the sphere or the process or the philosophy in the sense that I'm using it. The word philosophy is in the Bible, but not in the sense that I'm using it just now. The Bible does use terms that are exactly equivalent. Now, we have read today quite a number of references here in the Gospel according to John. And John speaks, the Lord Jesus speaks very, very emphatically in these passages about the Word. The Word. When you come to the writings, for example, of the Apostle Paul, he uses another term, it's very often translated the same in our English version, but it is a different term. It's properly translated the age. You've heard the Brennan speak of Romans chapter 12, does it? Be not conformed to this world. Or be not conformed to this age. So that Paul speaks about the age, this present evil world. Galatians 1, again, the word is this present evil age. John, in his writings, he speaks about the world, or you'll hear the preachers, and they will transliterate the word for you as the cosmos. Now, we're told not to love the world. And, of course, every reader of the Bible, he immediately comes up against a little problem, and he says, but sure doesn't it say God loved the world? And actually, it's the very same human writer, the Holy Spirit behind it all. But John in his Gospel says, God loved the world. John in his Epistle says, love not the world. You say one part of the Bible laughing at the other. Well, of course, and I'm not amplifying this particular part of my message, I'm assuming you're well au fait with it. The world is being used in those verses in two different senses. God has loved the world of humanity. And the world means the world. Every single person. God has loved the world of humanity. But when John uses that word, and the Lord Jesus in these verses that we've been speaking about often uses it, the world, love not the world. He's talking about that organized system of anti-God rebellion. Behind that organized system, we can see it around us, touches every avenue of society, whether it's commerce and business, whether it's the entertainment world, whether it's the social world, whether it's the political world, the religious world, you can see that every department seems to be in cahoots. And one department feeds into the other. You look at how much of the entertainment world has been absorbed by the religious world. Nowadays, dear people, there are services that are called church services. They're a bigger carry-on than any cinema could ever produce. Because into the religious world, so-called, there has been feeding and filtering those ideas of the entertainment world and the social world. Many assemblies have so many social activities. They could have a football team any day. What used to be an assembly and a church of God has become no better than a social club. You see, these ideas are filtered, and behind all this great big organization that's opposed to God and Christ, the Lord Jesus said to the prince, there's a satanic, sinister, majestic mastermind behind it all, and he has gathered together this whole big society. We find it very, very difficult to cope with. That's what we're speaking about this afternoon when we speak about a secular society. Now, I'll be mentioning some of these things more specific as we make our way along. There's another word that I want to mention to you. It's a very, students at university, you'll find this coming up in your campus from time to time, and if certainly you don't find the word, you'll definitely find the concept. But what is a worldview? Well, let me read you again one of these experts. A worldview is a set of presuppositions. Now, you're doing well. I'm going to give you 10 out of 10 here. If you can endure this until about a quarter to four, we'll all have a round of applause, I think. A worldview is a set of presuppositions which we hold about the basic makeup of our world. Or again, a second definition is, a worldview is an explanation and interpretation of the world, and it's an application of this view to life. Now, for example, in a worldview, a person has to ask, well, who made the world? How did this world start? Secondly, a person has to ask, where is this world going? Thirdly, a person has to ask, once we have established where it comes through, from where it's going to, how should it behave? In that broader context, how should human beings behave? And all of those different departments and presuppositions, they all go to make up a worldview. Now, if you have a flawed worldview, everything will be out of focus. You see, if I did it up, you people are even a bigger blur than you normally are.
Some of you are a blur already, as it is. But with, if I do that, I can see every single sleeping person. Because there was a qualified person one day saw that my worldview wasn't just properly adjusted, and he gave me two lenses. And through those lenses, I can see the color, and I can judge the distances, and I know exactly the sizes and the shapes, and the layers and the setup. Now, if these lenses were color, if these lenses were very, very seriously dusted up, as I would look through them, I would be receiving into my mind a distortion. And if I received a distortion and I was going down, I might bump into you. Or I might bump into the door. And I might do you an injury. And I might do myself an injury. Just because my lens and worldview would not be proper.
Of course, in the theological sense that you're speaking about this afternoon, the same thing happens. People have a wrong worldview.
They have their mind filled with presuppositions. I'm not talking about their physical sight. I'm talking about their moral sight.
And because their worldview is wrong, they end up doing themselves harm. And many of them end up doing great damage to others. Now, we have to have proper worldview.
So that we are looking at and assessing. We are assessing the whole business. Whether it's the world's entertainment, or the world's recreation, whether it's the world's religion, all those things that I have mentioned, we can look out across it with a worldview that has been biblically adjusted and educated.
And we can focus exactly and can weigh the whole thing up and see the proportions of what it is.
But if a Christian has his worldview infected and his vision blurred,
well then he will make a mistake in his adjustment with the world just as quickly and easily as anyone else.
Now, for example, let me mention a couple of these these big worldviews. They're maybe not so big nowadays, but I'm going to go back a little bit in history, and I'm going to move down. If you went back to, well, say about the early 1800s, that's a very broad generalization. Maybe even right through the 19th century. One of the most popular worldviews that was in vogue in those days is the worldview of deism.
You say, thanks very much. Not at all. Anytime you want it.
Deism. What is deism? Well, deism was the idea that God made the world, but after that, it had nothing to do with it. But they didn't deny the existence of God. They didn't deny that God was the creator. But just as the clockmaker would wind up his clock when he makes it, that's his job done. He gives you the clock, and it's up to you to keep it going ever since. God set it all up. He gave it over to us. He said, you people handle it. I don't care what you do with it. I have nothing. I have no part in it. You run the whole business as it suits you. That was deism. Now, deism sprang out of... it really sprang out of the Age of Enlightenment. You see, the Dark Ages, as they are called, Dark Ages religiously and many other ways, politically and philosophically and so on, those Dark Ages, that 1,000 years, produced very little in the world. It's really an awful valley in world history. But more of that some other day. But then there came the Age of Enlightenment and the revival of interest in literature and music. You take all those great music, some of you are fans of Mozart and all that. Where does that come from? And Sebastian Bach and all those things. And the great artists. Where did all that come from? The Age of Enlightenment, a renewal of interest in learning and art and the printing press and so on. Then the Age of Enlightenment was followed by the Industrial Revolution. And instead of people having to slave and slog with the sweat of their brow and get things done, they were able to produce machines. And one machine could do the work of 100 men. We can make this thing work. We can do it. We can do it. Do you see what we can do? Do you see the marvelous works of art that we can produce? Do you see the marvelous music that we can compose? Do you see the mighty machines that we are able to put together and the work that we can turn out? We can do this. Bye-bye, world God. You might have made this at the beginning, but science and technology, we will solve our own problems and we don't need God. Of course, that's with us for the present day. One of the biggest protagonists of that kind of philosophy is a good Englishman called Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins tells us now that it's possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Another one of those Oxford professors, Peter Atkins, he said that science and mathematics and modern day technology have rendered belief in God unnecessary. Any problems that we have, we will sort them out ourselves, and we will put together our brains, and we will put together our brawn, and we will sort it out, because within our own psyche and within our own intellect, we have the resources that can solve our problems. And God is unnecessary. That's deism that was right and is speeding down even into our present day. Mind you, dear brethren, you would not hold on. You wouldn't want that to get in here. You say, how would that ever get in here? Into Curtin Street Gospel? Oh, you say. Do you mean that we can do the job ourselves? Yes, we get the real gift of that. We get the best speaker. And we'll arrange the platform. And we'll get a man to do this, and we'll get a man to do that. And if we can pick the best men, and we can pull together with all our gift and all our ability, we'll make the meetings go. You'll make the meetings go nowhere. Listen, brother. Half the men and half the organization will do it if we have God. We cannot do the job without God. And we need to watch the deism never gets in here. Because Christianity is the very opposite of deism. Then, after that, of course, things took a little step in another direction. The next big philosopher that really, this is a worldview now, this is what I'm talking about, these worldviews, and these people that looked out on the world and said, it's ours to do what we like with it. God started it, but we finish it off. You can see what that leads to. Man becoming the worshipper of his own invention. Man becoming an idol and his own intellect and his own ingenuity. I tell you, it's a very, very serious business. God being robbed of his glory. The deification of man. The hymn that the deist gives out in most of his meetings is this. My man, O man, how great we are. The hymn the Christian gives out. My God, how great thou art. You see where the next big philosophy worldview was nihilism. There you are. I charge you £5 for the first one and it'll be £10 for the second one. Nihilism. It comes from the Latin word nihil, which, as you people know in primary two, means nothing. Nihilism. The philosophy of nothingness. The main protagonist of this philosophy of nihilism and this worldview, this is the world now. This is the world. The reason I'm going through all this is not just to be filling time or try to show you people what I know about it, because these are subjects about which I honestly know very, very little, but in which I have a little piece of an interest. And the reason I'm mentioning these couple of selections is because while we're going back now into the 18th century and 19th century, these things have fed into our day, into the 21st century. Now, the main protagonist of nihilism was a gentleman called Nietzsche, a German. He died in 1900, a wretched character. He died a maniac. His own sister had to lock him up in a room because he wasn't fit to live with. He died as a man in his 50s, deranged, sitting with a candle on his desk, clothes around and a black hood on his head and shivering. He died by common understanding of diseases that had been inflicted on his own body because of his own promised cure. You know what the main thesis, you know what Nietzsche's national anthem was? God is dead. God is dead. And that's a bit further than the first one I mentioned. You see, the first one said that God doesn't care, God doesn't control. They put God back to the beginning and said, now God started the world, but now it's ours. Nietzsche said, no, I'll tell you what, if we can manage to get God back in the age, he said, sure, I might as well go the whole distance and deny it all the time. He told in one of his very influential works, he told about a madman going about with a torch, hunting about in the corners and hunting about in the streets with this torch, and he says, where is God? Where is God? We have killed him. We have killed him. God is dead. And he hunts about in the dark holes with a torch, and God is supposed to be so non-existent that you can't even find him in the dark forest. God is dead became the champion anthem of the 20th century. And student movements all around the world. If God is dead, where did this word begin? If God was not there to produce this word, how did this word begin? Well, you say it must have been a big bang. Surely, that's it. It wasn't produced intelligently. It wasn't produced by special creation. Somewhere, somehow or another, there was a build-up of uncontrollable energy. And that build-up of energy just gave off. And there was an uncontrollable random explosion. And the universe was flung into being. And one bit went flying there and another here. And a million pieces over there. And there we have this jumble of the universe. It doesn't mean anything. The universe is meaningless. What about yourself, sir? If the universe is meaningless, what are you? What did he say? He said, I'm meaningless too. He said, I'm just a random collocation of atoms. He said, I haven't appeared in the world by any design. I haven't appeared in the world by any prearrangement of a sovereign divine being. He said, I have just landed on planet Earth by chance. I'm a piece of slime on the blue planet, as Jean-Paul Sartre said. And he said, I don't mean anything. Well, no wonder he died an idiot. That's where it finishes up. What does life mean? If the universe is random, and if I'm random, then life's random. There's no meaning to life. Life is just a jumble. And if there's no meaning to life, and you have banked all this philosophy of Nietzsche and nihilism, and it's just nothing, one great big zero, what do you do? What does that finish up with? How does that impact society? Well, what about modern art? I love this stuff. I love this stuff. Don't you love it? And you go to the National Gallery, and there's a massive big painting, and people are, like 200 people standing there with a drama. On a big blank sheet, it's a heap of unwashed clothes that not one of you ladies would allow to see in your 60 years on earth. A big heap of unwashed clothes. Oh, they say this is. Oh, this is a labor to the heart. Do you see that? What does that mean to you? And somebody said, the whole thing. And you see, it's just absolutely nothing. And then you say, well, we need our rest. We need our rest. Get us a cup of tea. And you go down to the Trafalgar Square and you'll go to some of those restaurants for a cup of tea and the beauty. Modern beauty. And you'll be crying within your soul within 2 minutes, would God raise Mozart from the dead? Modern music. Just the biggest jumbo of musical jargon that ever hit your ears. The disorganized decibels of modern government. Music. Nothing! Absolutely nothing. Then that's okay, you go down along the Thames. You can bear the arts and you can bear the music. And you go down along the Thames and you get a heart break. Because lined up on a couple of those bridges are a number of teenagers. Lives that could be useful, and they're just jumping off the edge.
You say, man, stop! What are you doing now?
Well, he said, life means nothing.
There's no point in living. I have nothing to live for. Life is just meaningless. And this is going nowhere.
And he jumped off the bridge, and without Christ, he goes to hell. That's where it all leads you to.
You see, these philosophies that are secularism, they're leading to secularization, that we don't need God, and then the whole thing is just meaningless, and it's a random business.
I'm glad, dear people, we'll be able to see before the day is out that we have something to live for. Now, as you said amen, but that's what we're telling you, we have something to live for, but that we have someone to live for. We have a purpose in living. Life is not, you know why? Because we believe that God created the world. We believe that God designed the world, that God cares for the world, that God controls the world. And when God has cut the web of human history off the loom of time, God will roll it all up. And the final tapestry will be for His eternal glory. Brethren and sisters, this idea of nihilism. We need to watch. You younger people, don't be drifting through life. You young lads, don't be caught into that idea of university. We have a word in Ireland. It's not English. But it'll do. You just glide around. And you just pull away your time. And you just drift. And you just lie about. Like that amorphous group of casual students. And you let your life slip through. I tell you, if God has saved you and put you into an assembly of His people, you have something to live for. And get a grip on life. And live with a singular purpose. Because we don't want any of that deism or nihilism. What about the third? You have to go for a drink, he said.
I'm ready for a drink myself. We're losing ground here with the clock. But we'll try and catch up.
The third philosophy that I want to mention ever so quickly, that is, it brings us a little bit up closer to time, a little bit up to scratch, is pragmatism. That's more easily understood. Pragmatism is the philosopher that very, very simply says, and it's true, it's some of these great thinkers are up on the top echelons of society, they're peddling this out through every media channel that they can find. It fills the House of Commons. It has riddled with corruption. Mr. Blair and his companions. It will bring new Europe crumbling down like the feet of clay. Pragmatism. Pragmatism is a philosopher that simply says, if it works, you're right. If it works. That's the only criterion for judging anything in the world. That's the worldview that you take through the lens of pragmatism. And when you're assessing anything, the only question you ask, is it right? You never asked that question. That question was last asked in 1964. You never dare to ask that for the last 40 years. Is it right? Not at all. We don't worry whether it's right or talking about the rights and wrongs. Does it work? Is it true? Don't be asking that, don't be stupid. If it works. Then of course, you see all this business of going out and getting married. And a piece of paper and a lifelong commitment until death do us work. That's very inhibiting. And that leaves you tied and bound. That leaves you held within the captivity of a matrimonial commitment. I tell you what we'll do. We'll just cohabit. Sure, it works. It works. And when it stops working, we'll go for the next one. It works. Don't be asking about, don't dare to ask about principle or bring principle into these things. The thing is, if it pleases us, if it suits us, if we enjoy it, and if it's practical. So long as it's practical, man, dear, don't be talking about principle and be a spoiler. For
doesn't work for you.
You know, we are not just to be Christian friends, fragments. Not just dear friends.
Listen, few people know this.
When it comes to Christian experience and life and testimony, it's not just a matter of getting things done.
We have a deeper philosophy. Things have to be done in God's way. So that practice has to be governed by principle.
Whether it's pleasurable, whether it's popular, whether it's the done thing, counts for nothing. So that these are the world views.
That's a novel place to finish, isn't it? I think I will draw the line there. And then I want to come back in the next session. I would advise you to drink two glasses of water and one glass of orange. And if they have any strong coffee, take plenty of it.
We carry on the subject. I've condemned these worldviews. Deism, nihilism, and pragmatism, and they impact our modern society, and we need to watch they don't get into our thinking. But then I want to ask, as we come to the next session, what worldview should we have? What lens should we wear? Is there anyone who is qualified to give us the proper worldview? Which philosopher will we follow?
I tell you, there's one philosopher. He was wisdom incarnate. And if you come back at 4:30, we will try and take a look at the world through the lens of Christ in the farewell ministry of John 13. Shall we bow?